You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Gillian Tobias, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up on today's programme, it's a knockout season in London for art. Ben Luke from the London Evening Standard will be here to take us through it.
And we'll cross to Riga to hear some cultural highlights happening over there in the coming days.
Riga may only be a city of roughly 700,000 people, but it definitely knows how to punch above its weight.
And we'll also be joined by Michael Salu, Artistic Director at Granta Magazine, to guide us through their new issue.
Plus some new music from Moshi Moshi Records, Stephen Bass, and a tip or two for the weekend. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. And next to me to my left is Tom Edwards with his cultural highlights spread across the studio table. You're in the mood, Tom.
I am. I've got a lot of additional material.
You do, you have props.
That's right. I like to be prepared, you know. I'm very professional that way. What have you seen this week? Anything particularly that struck you for good or bad reasons?
Yeah, no, it's been a good week. In addition to sort of discovering a lot of the exhibitions which we're gonna talk about later. I did go and see a matinee of Pina Bausch, and it's funny, at the time it was at the Sadler's Wells, and I came away thinking, oh, it was a bit long and I could have left that a bit early. It was very, very repetitive, but it kind of got under my skin, and I find I've gone back and started looking at her work and looking at the dance, and now I'm kind of intrigued to see Wim Wenders documentary he did on her. So you know, having felt a bit irritated by it, I'm kind of now curious.
A slow burn, if you will.
A slow burn. And you, Mr. Edwards?
Well, yeah. I mean, I stayed resolutely on my couch. Not very culture vulture-y, that is. But I watched in two sittings the entire Netflix new House of Cards, really as a kind of social experiment, you understand, Gillian, to test, is this the future? And I must say, binging on high quality television suited me very well.
Well, I love binging on high quality television, but I usually do it sort of on holidays when you have 2 weeks off. To do it on a work week, I'm impressed.
I can find time.
And did it stand up? You saw the American version, not the British version.
Yeah, the new one. I thought it was absolutely excellent. It had a lovely brooding quality, and although some rather far fetched elements, because it's so kind of brazenly allegorical about the nature of American politics in the present day, the kind of ins and outs of Capitol Hill, I found it superb. Kevin Spacey, excellent. He'll be delighted, I'm sure, to hear that I give him my seal of approval.
And have you lined up your next binge viewing?
I'm just gonna take a moment, you know, try and recover, and then launch myself back in again.
Okay, the time is 12:07 here in London. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Now, we start The Review this week in London, which is currently, I think it's fair to say, basking in the glory of some superlative art exhibitions recently unveiled all across the capital.
And to help shed some light on why critics across the board have been leaving London museums with a kick in their step this month, I'm delighted to welcome to studio Ben Luke, art critic for the London Evening Standard.
Hello.
Hello again. So, I mean, I seem to have noticed a lot of critics getting quite excited about the openings. Is it my imagination or is this a good season for London?
It's an extraordinary season. I mean, the Liechtenstein show at Tate Modern is one we're not talking about today, but it's a monster. And then you have last year it was the Cultural Olympiad, and I think everybody thought that 2013 would be a bit of a damp squib after that. But I think this is probably the greatest exhibition season I've come across in London. It's just extraordinary, I think. Full of excellent shows. And
that's exciting, given that we're just out of February.
Start of the year. No, it's amazing. Fast out of the blocks with some wonderful things, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, let's start perhaps with Picasso. Becoming Picasso at the Courtauld. It's an interesting space. It's not the biggest gallery. Sometimes they have to find works that work, you know, on a smaller scale. Have they pulled it off? I gather you say unequivocally yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's one of those shows. It is a small show. It's two rooms. It's, what, 20 works or so? But the quality of the works is phenomenal. The loans from the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, from the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, from the Pushkin Museum, you know, wonderful loans and a really beautifully focused show about 1 year in Picasso's life, a seminal year where he turned into Picasso, the great artist, in essence. It's his year when he went to Paris. He had his first exhibition, which was a tremendous success, and then very quickly changed tack and made a completely different kind of work. And that is a very bold step in his progression. And it's just, it's palpable in the show that you see an artist leaping into his true self, if you like.
Well, it is amazing because you walk up the stairs to the top of the almost attic at the Court Hall, yeah. And they're just two rooms, three rooms. So you can go round them and round them back. And it is amazing. This is 1 year in the life of Picasso, and you see him experimenting with Lautrec style. You see him experimenting with Degas. You see him, you know, as it says, the title is Becoming Picasso, and he's dappling, but to spectacular effect.
Absolutely. And what I loved about it was in that first room, it focuses very much on the works that were in that 1901 exhibition with Ambroise Vollard, who was a very influential dealer of his work throughout, you know, his early part of his life. And what I love about it is that you feel that Picasso is you feel his Spanishness still, even though he's looking at these French artists. You still feel the presence of Goya and Velázquez that are so deep-seated within him. So he almost channels that French Belle Époque feel with this incredible darkness and energy. And it's still very Picassian, you know, which is quite amazing because he's only 19, we have to remember, you know. So I think, you know, what I love about it is that you take that step into the next room and the shift from that sort of lighter, though still very vigorous style, to a much more melancholy and much more
blue.
Well, yes, it's the beginning of the blue period. It's much more considered. It's flatter in terms of the way that the paint's applied. It's just a big shift and a bold one because he'd had a successful show. You know, for most artists, I imagine if they'd had a big show where they'd sold works and they got critical attention, the temptation would be to keep going. But clearly, Picasso's journey was something he didn't want to be interrupted on, you know.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because often you find artists, particularly as they travel in these formative years of their working life, that they will sort of pay homage to artists that they encounter along the way, to styles that they identify. But it almost seems, in this exhibition, you get a sense that Picasso was almost more confident than that. It was about him honing his own craft by borrowing styles rather than paying tribute. Is that a fair comment?
I think that's true. I think one of the things is that you find this throughout Picasso's career. He is a thief. He admits he was a thief of other art, but he is such a confident artist, and he does have such a conviction in the way that he applies the paint and the way that he works, that I think it's the way he brings that influence into his style and brings that and adds power to his vision through other artists that is so remarkable about his work right the way through his career.
This is just a year in his life, 2001, and I was amazed to read that after this very successful exhibition, he went back to Spain penniless. And knowing what we know about Picasso, that is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary because having success and then making this shift, it wasn't a successful shift. It was a puzzling shift. And I think, you know, certainly for the next 10 years, Picasso makes lots of puzzling shifts. The Cubist experiment was initially confounding to many people. But he does have, gradually he gets patrons who do buy his work. But it's you know, Picasso, towards the end of his life, was a very rich artist. But certainly early on in his life, he did struggle. And, you know, that whole idea of the blue period as a period of, you know, the figures are wasted. They are, you know, they're penniless, and Picasso himself was struggling. I think there's that wonderful sense of struggle is what gives those works such conviction, I think, in many ways.
It's incredible to look at we mentioned already the focus on this one 12-month period, but an incredibly prolific producer of work. I mean, that is something that I always find difficult to process. You imagine the kind of mental challenge of delivering works, you know, in many cases that were real breakthroughs personally for him, for the movements at the time, and just an astonishing level of productivity.
That's
to,
right.
And to maintain it over a year in that way.
This journey, he was started the year in 1901 in Madrid and then travelled to Paris, and he had sketches and maybe one or two paintings, but essentially the works that he produced for the show in Paris, 64 works, were made in a six-week period. And you think of the quality of the work that he produced, and you can see some of that energy in the work, you know, some of that. There's one work, The Dwarf Dancer, which is like a blizzard of thick brush marks, and it's an extraordinary dots, and you know, this again very Goya-esque figure, and that is an incredibly powerful statement for a 19-year-old artist. Likewise, the self-portrait. His self-portrait, a wonderful self-portrait, incredibly energetic, and also incredibly confident, and you know, this big yo, I, Picasso, at the top of it, you know, announcing himself on the scene. There's a wonderful confidence, an incredible facility for a 19-year-old artist, wonderfully confident and incredibly accomplished already. So yes, I mean, you know, I always am amazed at the sheer volume of output that Picasso created, and so few of those works that he produces are poor, you know, which is even more remarkable.
Well, let's move on to another exhibition. This is at the Barbican, the Bride of the Bachelors, the Bride and the Bachelors. But before we talk about it, we're going to have a listen to the sound of this exhibition.
Now, Ben, I found this quite a challenge, I must say, because I'm not a self-professed fan of Duchamp and his oeuvre. And I sometimes find that when I see sort of, you know, Dadaist works or Absurdist works or this kind of thing, that I find it's a bit like sort of watching a music hall joke. It, you know, it's something that was very funny for those in the know a century ago, but it leaves me a little cold. But what I thought was really effective about this exhibition was how it depicts the relationship between Duchamp and these other artists across a number of different mediums, how close they were, how the kind of regard with which they held Duchamp. And I thought it's very well curated, how it delivers that feeling of that kind of community.
I think it's phenomenally well curated. And I think that this sense that you have Marcel Duchamp, who was not a terribly influential artist at that time, he'd been largely forgotten. And then you have this amazing group of New Yorkers. You have Merce Cunningham and John Cage, and you have Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. And they are incredibly close-knit group of four of them. And they have embarked on this journey. What's really intriguing, I think, about this show is a lot of the ideas were kind of there. They knew that they wanted to connect art and life, and they'd already started on their journeys. Robert Rauschenberg had made his white paintings, and John Cage had responded to Rauschenberg's white paintings by making his seminal, notorious 4 minutes and 33 seconds. This silence, a piece of silence, essentially. So already they'd embarked on this journey. Cage had come across Duchamp but not been as obsessed with him up until the 1950s. And then from the 50s, about the mid-50s, all these four artists in their different disciplines become obsessed with Duchamp and take on his ideas. They also form a relationship with Duchamp, who is delighted that his work is getting an airing. And in essence, this was the moment when Duchamp made the shift from a cult, influential, quirky figure on the sidelines to the greatest, most influential artist of the 20th century. These four artists propelled him to his very elevated position.
You talk about different disciplines. We have a composer, we have a choreographer, we have a painter. How do you see they're influenced in a Barbican exhibition? Do we see dance? Do we hear music?
On Thursdays and at weekends, you can see performances of Cunningham's work. The rest of the time, you can hear performances of Cunningham's work. Now, that sounds a very odd idea, but this is one of the crucial and most brilliant elements of this exhibition, is that Philippe Perrineau, who's a French-Algerian artist, who he was given the role of creating a mise-en-scène for this exhibition. And what he's done, I think, is rather wonderful, is create this situation where we have the ghosts of Cage, the ghosts of Cunningham. So what we have is the rumbling footsteps of dance. We have Disclaviers playing Cage pieces like the one we just heard throughout the exhibition. You have 4 minutes and 33 translated into the sound outside the Barbican, which is piped into the Barbican. You have these rather lovely and rather quirky kind of ideas to enliven the show, because I think that's a really good thing, because sometimes these museum shows can make artists who were very vigorous and exciting seem rather staid by putting them into the museum situation. I think what the Barbican has done rather brilliantly is bringing in Perrineau, making it really enlivens the work. And I mean, you know, the quality of the work throughout the show, I think, is just exceptional. The loans, again, are magnificent.
I particularly enjoyed, I must say, there's a room sort of dedicated to chants, which is obviously a very important sort of motif that continues through all of their works. Some really interesting John Cage works with strings and paint that he dropped. And I think probably my favourite pieces, which actually Rauschenberg's, these handkerchiefs that are then depicted, they almost have this sort of weird ethereal kind of death mask quality to them. But in terms of the sort of big marquee pieces, did you have any particular favourites, Prince Antolin, in the main room, some of those really monumental works?
Yes, there's this. I mean, there is a replica of perhaps Duchamp's greatest work and the most puzzled over work, which is the large glass, The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors, even as it's known. That's a replica. The actual original is in Philadelphia and would never be lent. But there are things like, I mean, the nude descending the staircase from 1912, which caused an absolute uproar in 1913 at the Armory in New York. It was, you know, one of the great moments of shock in early modern art. That's here, and that's next to The Bride, which is where Duchamp starts making his preparations for the large glass, and that's a wonderful work in itself, again a 1912 work. And then what I love is the ripples and overlaps between all these artists. You have Jasper Johns's responses to Cunningham's dance pieces. You have the piece that we just heard is Cage's direct response to Marcel Duchamp. You have poems by Cage inspired by Marcel Duchamp. You have works by a work by Jasper Johns by Duchamp, which is owned by Jasper Johns. You get this really clear idea of passion, a real passion for this artist, and they're trying to unpick it, trying to work it out, and trying to figure a way to forge into new areas with Duchamp as a kind of moral guide, if you like. And I think that you see this in very interesting ways in this very thematic structure, which I think is beautifully handled, actually, throughout the show.
We have time, I think, to dip into one more exhibition, and one really guided by you, because I have to admit, I'd never heard of Federico Barocci, and so I went along with a view to being able to discuss it today. And I was just amazed at this artist and the whole work of his paintings and drawings. But I wonder if you can set up who he is and why we've seen so little of him.
Well, exactly. I mean, in his own time, he was regarded as one of the great Renaissance, late Renaissance painters and an important figure in the development of the Baroque. And I think one of the reasons he's not very well known today is because lots of his work remains in Urbino, where he lived for most of his life, and hasn't really had an airing here. And you know, there's a work in the National, but it's one of his sort of sweetest and sickliest paintings, which is great. But when you walk into this show, it's just a total revelation. There's these extraordinary vast altarpieces, and as you say, these amazing studies, wonderful studies in oil and pencil, and you realise that he's one of the most meticulous, but also one of the most gifted artists of the Renaissance. And it's a simply revelatory show, I think.
Well, we could talk about that one forever, but Ben Luke, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review.
Thank you.
And if you are in London, Bride and Bachelors is on at the Barbican until the 15th of May. Picasso can be seen at the Courtauld until May 26th, and you have until May 19th to catch the wonderful Barocci exhibition at the National Gallery. And if not, fear not, because works by these artists can, of course, be seen at galleries in cities across the world.
For now, though, stay tuned. Up next, we'll be hearing from Nelly Gacheva with us to tell us her weekly look ahead this weekend.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
You're with The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Gillian DeBias.
And time to cross to our associate editor, Nelly Gacheva, to hear what cultural highlights she's dug up for us happening around the world this weekend and in the week ahead.
This weekend in London, visit Art 13, an art fair showcasing the works of international artists from 30 countries. The fair is set in the Olympia Grand Hall in southwest London. Big names include prestigious South African gallery Everard Reed from Johannesburg and photography gallery 2902 from Singapore. For more information, go to artfairslondon.com. Norway's leading contemporary dance company, Carte Blanche, performs in Montreal this Sunday. Expect great music and spectacular lighting combined with hypnotic dance performances. After Montreal, the Norwegian dance troupe will be performing at the Kennedy Center in Washington on the 6th and 7th of March before moving to the Joyce Theater in New York from the 15th through the 17th of March. And back in London, the annual self-publishers fair entitled Publish and Be Damned is at the Institute of Contemporary Arts. The fair features over 50 publishers and promotes alternative publishing possibilities and distribution strategies outside the mainstream. For more information, go to ica.org.uk. And finally, playing a handful of dates across the UK and Belgium this week is Parisian singer Melody's Echo Chamber. She will be in Brighton on Sunday before heading to Manchester, London and Brussels later in the week. For more details, visit dominorecordco.com. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was I Follow You by Melody's Echo Chamber, ending that report from Nelly Gotcheva. Melody is currently on tour in Europe. Well, staying on the topic of music, it's time now for our weekly music review. Joining us this week once again is record industry talent spotter, label head and general man about town, Stephen Bass.
Stephen runs the highly influential Moshi Moshi label, where artists including Hot Chip, Florence the Machine and Block Party started their careers and has gone on to sign a number of highly regarded acts from the world of indie and dance. Stephen, welcome back to the review. Now, tell us, I gather that South by Southwest is getting started later this week in Austin, Texas. You're off there, I believe. Paint us a little picture of South by Southwest. What are you expecting to find there this year?
You're rubbing it in because this year I'm not going. I think it's the first time for 10 years I'm quite heartbroken.
What are you missing out on?
This year is, it's just a chaotic barrage of bands and noise every corner. Every year it also gets more branded things, more ridiculous branded things happen. Last year there was a huge vending machine built in the middle of Austin in which performers were playing and things like that. Everyone turns up, and increasingly a lot of punters as well. So it's quite fun. You go and you just meet random punters that are there drinking, going crazy in the hot sun, seeing loads of free music. So I'm very sad not to be going.
Who are the kind of names that have been discovered there in the past, South by Southwest?
Alabama Shakes, I think, had a really great South by Southwest last year. The White Stripes, I think, were actually really had a real great launch there. Increasingly, it's not quite like that anymore. I think it used to be this little unknown thing that a few adventurous people... No one had heard of Austin, 15 years ago. I'd never heard of Austin. I was like, why are you going there? And it used to be that people would be discovered, but now nothing's discovered like that, and it's such a jamboree. It's got so big. It's quite hard to do that sort of thing there. So it's become... You have to be very focused to... go there with a real reason. You have to make your band do 7 or 8 shows at least, and they have to count because it's expensive to get there. It takes a long time to get there. Visas are hard to get for bands, for a British band. But having said that, I'm heartbroken not to be going. I've been bumping into people there. Are you going to Austin? But no, I went to another music conference a couple of weekends ago, if I can talk about that, Oya in Bilam Festival, rather, in Oslo, which was really good, had a really great time. And they have a conference there as well. It's obviously a lot more focused musically on Scandinavian acts. So I got my kicks. I had to make do with that there in the freezing cold, snowy Oslo, rather than in the hot Austin sunshine.
It sounds pretty atmospheric. So in terms of maybe spotting raw talent then, maybe South by Southwest no longer the best spot, where are the kind of places that you would go? And have you got any great new signings to your own roster recently from some of these far-flung places?
Well, I went to Bilam with the express purpose of seeing a singer that I'd just heard about, which I think we might play a song. That, you know, hopefully I'm in the processes of netting, and I wasn't expecting to see another act, but I saw another incredible performer, Anna von Hauswolf, who's coming over here in April, I think, who sounds like some ridiculous combination of ABBA meets Hawkwind, perhaps, who just completely blew me away. And, you know, I went to see her twice and, was unfortunately not signing her. She's just signing to another label. I don't even know if I'm meant to say, but you know, I wasn't expecting so it can happen. And I think in Oslo, it's a more smaller focused event, so it can still happen. And I think maybe the smaller ones, but just South by Southwest, it's very hard to explain exactly what it's like to go there. You know, it's just so vast and so huge and so endless. So it was a bit nicer. If you go somewhere a bit smaller, you can maybe find them. But yeah, Anna von Hauswolf was incredible. I'd have a listen to her.
Well, let's we're going to get try and get a sense and the sound of the kind of music you like to discover. The first one we're going to listen to is Fimber Bravo, "The Way We Live Today." Before we hear it, maybe can you just set up who they are and what interests you about them?
Fimber Bravo is a steel pan, Trinidadian steel pan player. He won't tell me how old he is, but he's had a long career of playing and being sampled by other people and playing with Morcheeba and different musicians. He recently played on a Hot Chip recording and in some live stuff with them, and it was Alexis from Hot Chip who sent me his record and said, you know, I think you might like this. And you know, it's very, very different. He's worked with a number of producers, Mickey Moonlight, Zongamin, Alexis himself from Hot Chip. So it's just a very different sounding record with a steel pan very much to the fore, which is, you know, when you see it played in such a way, it's a really emotive, beautiful instrument.
Well, let's have a listen now.
The way we live today, the things we do and what we say, the way we live today, the things we do and what we say, the way we look into our lives, the things we never, never seem to realize. The way we're living today, how it makes me wonder, oh, how I wonder. Oh, in this modern world today, artificially it's a mountain because of that need.
That's Fimber Bravo, "The Way We Live Today." Incredible sounds there. Where might we be able to hear a little more very soon? Anywhere, will we be lucky enough here in London to get a chance to listen to a bit more?
There's an Art Wednesday event, I think, on the 13th of March. Him and Anna Meredith is going to be performing there. I think it's called It's Nice to Meet You. Anna Meredith is another artist we work with. She's a classical composer, but she's making electronic music. So again, it's a bit of a awkward mesh that comes out with something completely different.
I mean, great to hear them on the airwaves, but I can imagine seeing an artist like this live must be wonderful.
It's the steel pan. He played the first live show we saw him do at Servants Jazz Quarters. We put on a show, and it just brings so much instantly, both a sort of, it's quite spiritual and he talks about it in that way, but then also it brings the rave pretty quickly as well, especially when you're right near it, you know. So yeah, he's a lot of fun to watch.
You know, the song was called The Way We Live Today, and that makes me think about, you know, the changing face of music, how it, both the production, all of these things evolve over time. We talk a lot on Monocle 24 about sort of vinyl revival. I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think that that's something that we're really seeing? Is it a classic kind of histrionic sort of media thing, the vinyl revival, or is it... is it a real thing that's out there that people really sort of still caring about?
It's definitely happening. There's labels starting up that are doing only vinyl. There's a label that does only film soundtracks. They do a lot of vinyl. Sales are definitely going up. If you go into record shops, it's actually, you know, there's a couple of, as much as there's lots of record shops closing, they're opening as well. I mean, I'm trying to do some record deck thing, so I've even been in touch. This week I was in touch with a record deck manufacturer, just asking about how things are going, and he was like, well, we're increasing capacity all the time and there's nothing I can do till June because we're busy till then. So
that's amazing.
If it's true, you know,
that's good news, isn't it?
Yeah, which is, it's good. I mean, it's quite niche, but you know, but if people care, that's all you want, really.
Well, not on vinyl, but we are going to hear your next track now. This is something from Miriam and the Believer. What have you selected?
I've selected The String of Everything. And this is the girl that I went to see in Oslo. She used to be in a band called Wild Birds and Peace Drums. And it's her first solo album. I think she's pretty incredible.
We will have a little listen now.
Belief as rustiness, humming as the song lives on, and the glory will keep on vibrating the string of everything, vibrating the string of everything, vibrating of everything, the string of everything.
Was A String of Everything, Mariam and the Believer. Just wanted to ask you, Stephen, it's quite interesting, the sort of vocal style. I mean, you mentioned that Wild Birds and Peace Drums duo. What kind of, is it a different kind of sound? Do you think she's sort of evolving, or is that, but that's very much a kind of signature sound that we're hearing there.
This is her. Wild, the other band still will continue, but I think this is, it's just a thing that's personal to her, so it's the way she wants to go. I think she's just, I mean, I went and met her and she's just one of those people that just is very creative, has got very strong ideas of what she wants to do. So, and you just know that the next album will have other strong ideas. And there's just sort of, these people are fun to watch and also to work with, you know, because they'll stretch you a little bit.
That makes, you know, your life, makes your life a bit easier, doesn't it?
Well, not necessarily easier, but more interesting. So, you know.
I love the way we get introduced to music like this. And at Moshi Moshi, you have a really interesting way of having people be able to discover and buy singles, I gather. Your singles club?
Yeah, we had a little hiatus with that. We just started again. We did the first Telly Man single came out a few weeks ago. We have one called Casual Sex coming up.
So what is it? What's the idea behind it?
It was just, we started off, I guess, releasing singles at first, and then we get into releasing albums because it's crazy releasing singles as a business. And then just after a while, you just want to go back to doing something that's quick and easy, and you can just find a band and say, right, let's get something out. It will help you. It'll be good for us, you know, and you just want to... We just like to be active and involved, you know. I'm not really a sort of standing around. It's a bit of a personality disorder in a way. I hear something, I want to get involved and do it. So it was a really simple way to do it. You can have a nice ethos. You can get the bands do all their own artwork. Only sing, only one colour, but they can do whatever they want. So it's a very simple way of presenting new music. And this is how we found a lot of, you know, we did the first Licky Lee single, the first Disclosure single. We've done work with all these great bands. So it's sort of something to be proud of and just keeps us busy as well. You know, I think you have to, you know, you only get out of life what you put into it, as my mum always used to say. So I think it's just sort of, you know, just get on with it and do things. So this is sort of why we did it. And it started again and it's very excited to have it back, really.
That's a good lesson for the day. Stephen, we're sort of running out of time, but yep. I want to, before we say goodbye, just play one more song. We're going to hear Sweet Baboo. Tell us a little bit about this one.
He's released two or three albums himself. He's from Wales. He's a funny little chap, but I think makes really beautiful, heartfelt music. And I think that phrase, heartfelt, has rung to me a little bit over the last year or so. I thought the Two Bells album, their lyrics is just really heartfelt. So we had a single of his called Let's Go Swimming Wild recently that had a brilliant response on Six Music. And instead of doing anything clever and trying to pick the best radio record, we just sort of picked our favourite song. And, you know, miraculously everyone responded and it had more radio play than, you know, anything else we've released, almost, in a way. So, and this is not a single from the album that we're playing, but it's just possibly my favourite song, a really nice track he wrote, honestly, about a good friend of his.
All right, well, we are going to hear Sweet Baboo, Kate's song, to play you out. Stephen Lovely. Best from Moshi Moshi Records, thank you for joining us.
Thanks
here
for having
the
me.
Dance mats, noticed that our shoes match. By the end, my feet were bare. Cause you said we now share. And I never thought we could have. But I'm so glad we do have. And I hope that you do know that I'm just being slow. Ourselves with singing harmonies to Sean Glynn's house where we did go to practice for our shows. And I'm afraid.
That was Sweet Baboo, Kate's song. I think I can see, Gillian, why Stephen Bass was such a fan of that one. But time now to spin the globe and drop in on a global city to hear what's happening here over the coming days. Today, our pin has landed on Riga. Monocle's Phil Hahn is there to guide us through.
Riga may only be a city of roughly 700,000 people, but it definitely knows how to punch above its weight. Despite it being a rather chilly and snow-covered time of year, that doesn't stop people here in the Latvian capital from enjoying their time off. This weekend, the Estonian music band Ewert and the Dragons are in town for a performance at the Palladium Riga.
How could you shoot a good man down?
That was a bit of their 2011 Song of the Year, Good Man Down. And although they are one of the most well-known bands in the region, you can be sure their plans will be much wider. But if a mix of Baltic indie folk music isn't your thing, then head over to the Latvian National Opera in the old part of town. This weekend, audiences will fill this gorgeous 19th century building to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Latvian composer Josef Vitals. The LNO will bring together soloists and the entire company for this once-in-a-lifetime performance. But if you're after something a bit more dramatic, later in the week, don't miss the revival premiere of Wagner's Das Rheingold. This adaptation from 2006 will be performed again for just two nights. Later this week, Riga's Photography Museum will also host a rather emotional exhibition of images of Latvian orphans from the 1990s. But what makes this even more powerful is that each portrait has a handwritten message from that child. Valts Kleins' exhibition is simply called We Wish, We Want. But if none of those events tickle your fancy, head down to Kanepes Kultūras Center, a place where art meets people and people meet art. Every night, there's a film screening to a new exhibition. Plus, throw in some good food, a few glasses of wine or two, and you can be sure it'll be a good evening. For Monocle, in Riga, Latvia, I'm Phil Hahn.
You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to hear more about the writing and the photography in the latest edition of Granta.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Maranushi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Tom Edwards, and Gillian Tobias. Now, we love to discover new writing here on The Review, so we always await each new issue of Granta, a compendium of contemporary thinkers with much anticipation. And when a hot-off-the-press copy lands on our desks, we crack open the spine and flick through the pages in a heartbeat.
Michael Salu is Granta's artistic director, and I have the pleasure of welcoming him to our Midori House studios.
Hello.
Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to focus our chat this morning on the writers and photographers in Granta's current issue, themed Betrayal. So I thought to help do justice to the theme, it might help if we tease some of the writing. So I've shortlisted some quotes from your writers, and sort of in a round-robin style, let's hear what they have to say, starting with you.
Excellent. So this is from Mohsin Hamid, and he says, "Betrayal is when someone you love forces you to accept the proposition that life is not the way you wish it to be. Indeed, that life never was this way, and that there is nothing in your power that can be done to change this. Betrayal is therefore pain and also education."
And I have a bit of writing from another contributor to the Betrayal issue. This is from Karen Russell. Judas Kirsten Scott, Bernie Madoff, Charlie Tuna. There are so many great case studies of betrayal, and yet I find it hard to put to words the dreadful thrill and or agonizing stab in one's belly pit that signals to a body this is treachery. I do think that the best traitors must be experts when it comes to self-deceit. They learn the art at home, chloroforming whatever internal voices suggest, better not do this. You are reneging on a deal. You are breaking a promise. You are crossing over to a shadowy frontier.
And I've got a small extract from Janine Di Giovanni. "The worst betrayal is the one you commit against yourself. It's when you realise you did not see something obvious. You could not see. You refused to see. Your vision was tainted. It means your instincts, which in my case I rely on to stay alive, betrayed you. There are people I believed in who let me down. I did not feel their betrayal nearly as acutely as I felt the betrayal of my own self. How could I not have known?" And I think that's very interesting. This is dealing with Syria, and I suppose in many respects, the kind of contemporary landscape for writing, both journalistic and creative writing, there's so much about betrayal, not just nation states, politically. It seems a very sort of dynamic time to cover this kind of theme. Is that what sort of was largely behind the decisions? I think this is
a universal affliction in itself, isn't it? And and given a lot of the movements that we have in our sort of, you know, economic and social environment now, and Syria is a very good example. And we sent Janine to Syria, and it's sort of coverage of the country's descent into full-blown war. And these really odd juxtapositions that happen within, you know, the same locale. So, you know, you'll have the affluent still having their sort of rather decadent parties around swimming pools, and in the background you can see plumes of smoke, you know, from, say, you know, just at least 5 miles away where the conflict is actually going on. So we cover that. Then we also look at fiction. We also look at personal relationships. We also look at the idea that betrayal, is that something that starts in the mind? Is it so much the action, or is it just the thought about the action? And then there's sort of metaphorical betrayal. We look at our relationship with something like fire, which is such a volatile but very important element in our lives, but it needs to be treated carefully, and it can react and betray you very instantly. So there's so many sort of, you know, interesting tangents on this theme, and it's been a really enjoyable one to put together.
I absolutely adore the way Granta will take a theme and run with it. And in the context of new writing, when you look at this issue, you know, what do you think we're seeing? How exciting is this in terms of the writing that hits the page?
I think it's the scope of it. I think it's the fact that this issue does have a lot of fiction, but it's fiction that's kind of, It feels like it's pushing boundaries, because there are pieces in there that sort of weld reality and the fantasy as well. So, you know, you use the fantasy in the context where you're actually trying to say something about something much more direct, something much more politically charged. I think of one of our stories in there, in which a masseuse kind of sort of starts a relationship through a professional relationship with one of her clients who's an Iraq war veteran. And through that kind of, through the regular massage sessions, she gets to, there's a transference of his pain through to her. And it's very much talking about, you know, sort of post-traumatic stress disorder and so on and so forth. But it's done in this way that is really lyrical, and you don't necessarily think about the context. You think about what you would be like in that situation.
Now, talk to us a bit about the presentation of this volume, then. You'd be forgiven, I guess, for thinking that the colour of betrayal is red, almost. Talk to us about some of the artistic decisions that went into some of the illustration and the general composition.
Certainly. I mean, a lot of the... You'll notice that for a change, the illustrations throughout this issue are quite figurative. That was a conscious decision, because we were thinking about the use of... the film vernacular, you know, like sort of film stills and film imagery, and the fact that, you know, you're trying to capture a little bit of a narrative in a moment. So rather than be too kind of, you know, esoteric about it, we've been quite direct in the way we use an illustration in this issue. And the cover is actually an image that came from an artist called Frederick Fontenoy. And it's simply a photograph of blood mixing with milk. And I couldn't really think of a better way to articulate that theme than those two things, which shouldn't really belong together.
And the other evening I went to a wonderful salon, which was a Granton salon, talking about photography and photojournalism. And we used, or you used as a case study, one of the articles here, which is called Julia by Darcy Padilla. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why this sits in an oeuvre about betrayal, and also your approach to photojournalism.
This was an interesting project for me, because there was a little bit of sort of jostling within myself and within us and the editorial department about whether we wanted to publish this piece of work or not. I'll give you a quickly explain. This Julie project by Darcy Padilla is it spans 18 years, and it's almost not necessarily an 18-year project, more of an 18-year relationship between the photographer and the subject. So it starts out as a photography project. And then she gets really sort of compelled, for whatever reason, which she doesn't actually say, by Julie's life. Julie's suffers from, you know, it's incredible amounts of poverty in the environment she's grown up in, domestic abuse and so on and so forth, and that transfers itself into her adult life. She suffers with addiction and consequently AIDS. But in this time, the photographer and Julie herself have developed this really interesting relationship, and it goes on over a period of time. There are long sort of absences where she's not around, but they retain this connection. And I was really interested to see why this relationship lasted so long. But then we look at the photographs, and the photographs don't necessarily say that much. And, you know, are we being simply exploitative? Are we being voyeuristic in publishing this work?
So does the betrayal relate to the photographer betraying its subject, or why does that fit in your theme?
Well, that's how we saw it. And I think in Darcy even says it herself in her introduction, where she's still compelled to take pictures, even though she's looking at this woman's life capitulating, but she still feels the need to take these pictures. And for what reason? Is she betraying her? Is she betraying the trust that she's, you know, Julius invested in her? But at the same time, Julius has allowed her to enter her life in this way. And then, you know, there's another level of this to, you know, as editor as well, about publishing this. And what am I betraying, you know, as a result of publishing this work? But then equally, I felt, because I was so uncomfortable, that actually means that this is probably the right thing to do. So just to get that conversation going.
I just wonder then about the role then of the reader or the viewer in this case.
Yeah.
Is it a sort of study then of the nature of voyeurism? I mean, can there be a sense of betrayal then from the reader, that end user, if you like? They're not involved in the creative process.
No.
They haven't had those kind of deliberations you mentioned from the editorial perspective.
Yeah, sure.
Is it then just a study in betrayal, or are they also in some ways kind of complicit?
I think they're complicit in a sense. I mean, that's what I mean by sort of various layers of it. So there's the project, and then there's our editorial sort of touch to it, and then there's the end reader, the end viewer. And I think the end viewer is going to have some confliction about what they're looking at, because they know how intrusive and how voyeuristic this is. But equally, there's often a bit of a mirror to our own lives in some tiny aspect of this kind of photojournalism. And I think that's what we were talking about in our salon as well. And it's just about having the kind of right ethical balance with this sort of work. And I think we've probably slightly tipped the balance here, but in a really interesting way.
I was interested in your salon. One of your speakers was saying that, and he felt very strongly about, you can't be a photojournalist without a political point of view. And I was surprised by that, because I think maybe sometimes it brings, good photographs. But on the whole, I thought maybe that's a dangerous position. And I wonder what you thought about that.
I thought it was a really interesting point. I think what he was saying was, I mean, I think he uses politically in a very loose sense, but what he's saying is principally is that you can't be objective if you're a photographer and you're photographing the real world and the real environment, because ultimately your role in that process, the fact that you are there documenting, is an intervention itself, and you're already kind of changing the shift, the course of events, by being there and being that reporting back. And therefore, even if you're operating as an independent, you're still going to have an opinion, you're still going to have a reaction to it, and something that you're trying to shape through the way you take your photographs and the way you present them and so on. So I think you need to have a standpoint, maybe not necessarily a political one, but you need to have somewhere that you're coming from when you're embarking on such projects.
I wanted to ask you briefly about one of my favourite stories, actually, from this volume. It's Safety Catch by Lauren Wilkinson. Mm. It's interesting talking about how the looking at the artworks and talking about cinematic visions, because this was a story that sort of jumped off the page to me. It read like almost like a movie script. I could sort of visualise it as a movie playing out. Do you think is there an element of betrayal there? Do you think there's like a literary betrayal of people seeing things and imagining them onto the big screen rather than just appreciating them for the literary craft that's gone into it?
Well,
them.
It's interesting you say that, because this sort of, I was thinking about it, this is partly why we went for the more kind of film still approach to the imagery, because betrayal is obviously a very strong visual device that we've used throughout our film culture and so on. And it's sort of, and a lot of that starts with literature like this. I mean, the story you're talking about, you know, spans a series of decades, continents, but it's all very succinctly put together in a short form. And I think there's a very strong relationship between literature and film in that sense. And betrayal is just one of those things that you can then pull out, you can expand upon, you can condense really easily into a short story.
Well, Michael Salu, we could talk forever on the topic. And next time we look forward to the thud of your next issue of Grant.
Coming
thanks,
soon.
Thanks so much for joining
thanks for
us
having
today.
Me.
And that does indeed bring us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, from all of us here at Midori House, our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheca. Our studio manager was Ben Jay. For more culture on Monocle 24, tune into Culture with Robert Bound today at 1800 London time, or the new edition at 1900 hours on Monday. Here, what's next week in store?
On the latest edition, we ask how you export Saudi Arabian art. We go all the way to Ouagadougou just to watch films, and we hang out with that funk soul brother, Jamie Liddell.
We are handing over back to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Robert Bound and Andrew Tuck.
And even myself, Gillian, I'm going to be jumping into the studio tomorrow with Robert and Andrew to bring you some more. A look ahead to the week on that show. So it's an extra reason to tune in, as if you needed one. But in the meantime, you have been listening to The Review with me, Tom Edwards, and Gillian DeBias. Have a great weekend wherever you are in the world.
Bye-bye.